Lecture 11, Fall Holidays.
Okay, we're moving back now into a discussion of the Jewish calendar, and we are going to start at an appropriate place, the new year. Now, imagine that on July 1st, someone comes to you and says, Happy New Year! You would look at them and scratch your head and think that they were way off base. But indeed, the Jewish New Year is celebrated on the first day of the seventh month of the Jewish calendar, the first day of Tishrei. Rosh Hashanah means the head of the year, and it is celebrated as the Jewish New Year. But why would it possibly be celebrated on the first day of the seventh month? The Torah describes the first day of the seventh month as a sacred occasion that is commemorated with loud blasts, and that is the shofar. A shofar is usually a ram's horn, although it doesn't have to be from a ram, but that's what it says about the day, the first day of the seventh month in the Torah. It obviously is not called Rosh Hashanah. It is obviously not called the New Year. It's the first day of the seventh month. Jews celebrate this New Year festival on the first day of the seventh month, probably because this was the time of the Babylonian New Year. So when the Jews were exiled to Babylonia, they saw that the Babylonians celebrated their New Year on that day, and they said, oh yeah, we've got some day, some sacred occasion where we blow the shofar, we blow the trumpets, so let's make that our New Year too. In so much of Jewish thought and so much of Jewish practice, you see an absorption and then a switch, a kind of twist, a Jewish twist that the minority population gives to the majority population's practices. You've got to remember, even in America, where being Jewish, you don't really feel so much like a teeny tiny minority. Jews are only 2% of the United States today. So in antiquity also, Jews were a very small percentage of the larger majority cultures that they were part of, and so they absorbed elements of those cultures. Now, let's remember that the Babylonians believed in astral determinism, in other words, in astrology. The stars control our fate. The Babylonian holidays involved tablets of destiny. The stars are going to tell you whether you live or whether you die. When the Jewish community absorbed those elements of Babylonian religion, they modified it and made it Jewish. Jews can influence their destiny through teshuvah, repentance, prayer, and tzedakah, giving charity. Thus, rabbinic Judaism rejected the fatalism of Babylonian astrology. It empowers its adherents to believe that we have some control, some influence over our fate. But saying that, it would be hubris to think that we totally control our fate. It would be too much. It would be arrogant. But the idea that we have some influence and not everything is determined by the stars, that's something that the rabbis very much wanted to promote. So the Babylonian tablets of destiny were transformed into the rabbinic books of life and death. And it says in the New Year's liturgy that on New Year's you will be written either in the book of life or in the book of death. But we have the power to change from one to the other depending on our deeds. Rosh Hashanah for the rabbis celebrates the creation and the teshuvah of the first human beings. Let me read you a text. Rabbi Eliezer says that the world was created on the 25th day of Elul, the sixth month, and humans were created on the first day of Tishrei. That's a statement in the Talmud. In other words, what Rosh Hashanah commemorates or celebrates is not the birthday of the world, but the birthday of human beings, the completion of the world, right? God did, in this reading, God did God's work in 6 days, and we're celebrating the conclusion of that 6-day process, which is also the birth of male and female. God created them in God's image, the birth of human beings. When the rabbis read Genesis 1 next to Genesis 2, they understand these two creation stories give you very different details, and there is some tension between them. So one of the ways that the rabbis reconcile that tension is by suggesting that the Garden of Eden story happens on one day, which is the sixth day. So here's how it works. On the same day Adam and Eve were created, they were placed in the Garden of Eden, they were commanded not to eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and if they did, on that day they would surely die, and on that day they surely did eat from the fruit of the tree. And then what would you expect? You would expect that they would die, because that's what God threatened them with. But they don't die. They become mortals. They eventually die, but they don't die on that day. How could it possibly be that they don't die on that day, the rabbis ask? Is God not good to God's word? Of course God is. The only possible explanation for the rabbis was that after the transgression, Adam and Eve did teshuvah. They repented for their transgression, and God, in God's mercy, relented, and instead of killing them on that day, just made them mortal so that eventually they would die. That's the rabbinic understanding of that first day. Ah, so now we understand why we celebrate that day on Rosh Hashanah, because there's precedent. Just like the first people were commanded and got it wrong and repented and were forgiven, so too, God, show mercy on us. We have been commanded. We have gotten it wrong. We are now doing tshuva. Please show your grace on us and don't punish us to the extent that you could with your strict attribute of justice, but shine mercy upon us the way that you shined mercy on our human ancestors, Adam and Eve, in the Garden of Eden. So that's the conceptual calendar link to the creation of the world, the creation of human beings. The liturgical readings for the day of Rosh Hashanah focus on the births of Isaac and Samuel. It's a day to celebrate the creation of new worlds. 9 days later, on the 10th day of the seventh month, we have Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. In the Bible, Leviticus 16 describes the ceremony that purged the tent of meeting of impurity. The Torah then calls on all the Israelites to practice self-denial, self-affliction, on the 10th day of the seventh month as a law for all time. Now, what is self-denial? In other parts of the Tanakh, of the Hebrew Bible, self-denial, or inui nefesh, is associated with fasting, as in Isaiah 58 and Psalm 35. But the rabbis added a few more prohibitions and explicitly included the teshuvah for transgressions between human beings. This now comes from the Mishnah. On Yom Kippur, it is forbidden to eat, drink, wash, moisturize, wear sandals, or have sexual relations. Now, that prohibition against wearing sandals, for those of you that have been to synagogue on Yom Kippur, you will see many, many, many people in this country wearing shoes. The prohibition about wearing sandals was understood as not to wear objects of leather, right? Perhaps because leather comes from other animals, and that's not a day that you want to be responsible for taking the life of others, of other of God's creatures. Like, you don't eat, you certainly don't eat meat, right? But you don't eat anything. There are some people today that have revived the interpretation of going to synagogue barefoot. They also don't wear leather, but they also don't wear sandals on their feet. Another text from that same chapter of the Mishnah: Yom Kippur does not atone for interpersonal transgressions until one appeases his fellow. So what the rabbis do is they build a day into the Jewish calendar that is dedicated to cleaning up your stuff. All those relationships that require, all those issues in your relationships that require closure, all those dangling threads that, you know what, I don't want to deal with it now. Well, before Yom Kippur comes, you are strongly encouraged to deal with those. And if you need to make amends by apologizing, if you need to make amends by restoring the person's property or money, that's the push, that's the impetus. And it's those 10 days in between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur that provide the window of opportunity to engage in cheshbon nefesh. Literally, cheshbon nefesh means something like an accounting of the soul. But a nice translation is soul searching. And what it's about during those 10 days that's built into the Jewish calendar is to right our relationships with others and with God. And we do that on both the micro level and the macro level. For instance, it's not just about, am I doing a good job at work? Is there any specific thing that I should be improving on? Are there any specific relationships I should be working on? That's the micro level. But what Yom Kippur and Cheshbon Nefesh, soul searching, requires us to do is to take a step back and say, am I working at the right job? Is this what I should be doing with my life? Is my relationship with my partner going in the right direction that I want it to move in? Not just are things smooth between us, but are they smooth moving in the right direction? The High Holiday Liturgy says, on Rosh Hashanah, it, your fate, is written, and on Yom Kippur, it is sealed. But the severity of the decree can be passed over or mitigated through teshuvah, prayer, and tzedakah. So the rabbis understand that 10-day period in mythical language, that our names are written down in the Book of Life or the Book of Death on Rosh Hashanah, but those books stay open. Those books are not sealed until Yom Kippur. And then, right, we've got up until that 10th day, and there are even some rabbinic midrashim to suggest that even the next holiday, Sukkot, which falls on the 15th day of that 7th month, that's really the last time. In other words, the rabbis want to give you every opportunity, give you every encouragement, give you every incentive to clean up your relationships. And this is the time of the year where cleaning up your relationships, both with God and other people, and yourself, is saliently emphasized in the tradition. Now, on Yom Kippur, the rabbis, or for Yom Kippur, the rabbis engage in historical revisionism. So here's how they understand Yom Kippur. Just like the rabbis understood Rosh Hashanah as the birthday of humanity, the rabbis imagine that the second set of tablets, the Decalogue, the two tablets, were given on Yom Kippur as a reward for the teshuvah and the cheshbon nefesh, the soul-searching, that the Israelites engaged in following the sin of the golden calf, right? I would say that in Judaism, certainly in the Torah, it's the sin of the golden calf, it's idolatry, that's original sin, right? Not in the Christian sense, but in the sense that it's the most egregious transgression, and it's the most common transgression. Placing something else at the center of your life other than God and God's will. And that's what the sin of the golden calf represents. So Yom Kippur represents the Israelites who had engaged in this egregious transgression of the golden calf, then 40 days later, receiving God's grace when Moses comes back down with the second set of tablets, right? That is also the paradigm that we hope to emulate. So 40 days before Yom Kippur is the first day of the 6th month of Elul, and that begins this period of traditional preparatory activity. That's when you really start thinking. In traditional synagogues, a shofar is blown each morning at sunrise, and the shofar is a rallying cry, right? Wake up from your slumber. What have you been doing in this world that you need to wake up to and fix and do better, do in keeping with your understanding and the tradition's understanding of God's will? Notice also the connection between soul-searching, fasting, and 40 days that appears in Christian scriptures as well. The climax of the Yom Kippur worship service is to imitate the high priest in the temple and prostrate oneself and repeat the ancient formula beseeching atonement. Now think about that for a second. In traditional synagogues, Jews get down on their first on their knees, and then they're splayed out all together on the ground in imitation of the high priest. The temple's destroyed after the year 70. Now, one day a year, for one moment of one day on Yom Kippur, when in the temple, the priest could actually say the Tetragrammaton. That we can't do. But every Jew is empowered to imitate the high priest. We can become the high priest for that moment, receiving atonement, beseeching atonement for ourselves. That further exemplifies this desire of rabbinic Judaism to democratize and make things more egalitarian. It's no longer about what the priest does for us. It's about what we do for ourselves, in this case, in imitation of what the high priest used to do. Readings for Yom Kippur include the Book of Jonah, that highlights God's desire for teshuvah and the gracious bestowal of mercy. Also, Leviticus 18, not 19, but Leviticus 18 is read in the afternoon service on Yom Kippur, and that is the chapter of the Torah that details the laws of sexual transgression, adultery and incest and homosexuality and bestiality. My suspicion is that they felt that there was a need, when everybody was in synagogue paying attention, although at that point in the afternoon on Yom Kippur, because you've been fasting, you're flagging a bit, but when everybody's there, to really emphasize the centrality of the family and the damage that can happen to the family when these laws of sexuality are transgressed. Our next holiday, on the 15th day of the seventh month, is called in Hebrew Sukkot. It's translated into English as the Holiday of Tabernacles. A sukkah, the plural of Sukkot, is a hut or a little tent, something like that, that's open on at least one side. And what it says about the holiday in the Hebrew Bible is that because God caused the Israelites to dwell in these temporary structures, these Sukkot, during the 40-year sojourn in the desert, so every year on the 15th day of the seventh month, we should build these Sukkot. We should build these tabernacles or these huts. In the biblical period, this was actually a pilgrimage festival to Jerusalem. There are three pilgrimage festivals: Sukkot, Passover, and Shavuot, which is often translated as Pentecost. And we'll be talking about Passover and Pentecost in the next lecture. But the holiday of Sukkot was known in rabbinic literature as the holiday. It was a tremendously joyous festival and pilgrimage in order to celebrate the summer harvest. It's important to remember that part of the religious revolution of the Torah is to combine the gods of nature with the gods of history. And we see that in this holiday of Sukkot, where on the one hand, it celebrates an event in nature, the harvest, the fruit and vegetable harvest of the summer. On the other hand, it commemorates an event in history, the Exodus, not the Exodus of Egypt, but the sojourn for 40 years in the desert. So this one holiday combines the natural and the historical, the way that the new understanding of God combines the natural and the historical. The Torah also speaks of taking from four species and rejoicing before the Lord. Now, the rabbis and the Karaites, we mentioned the Karaites a few lectures ago, that was that medieval heresy that didn't accept the rabbinic interpretation of the Torah. So the rabbis and the Karaites disputed about what those four species were. But the rabbinic list is an etrog, or a citron, looks like a lemon, a willow, a myrtle, and a palm frond. All of these symbols, all of these four species, either require much water or grow by sources of water. And water becomes very important in the imagery of Sukkot. We'll get there. For the rabbis, in the Bible, there were 70 animal sacrifices that happened during the seven-day holiday. Sukkot is a seven-day holiday. And the rabbis understood that these 70 animal sacrifices during the festival corresponded to the 70 nations of the world. So what Sukkot does in terms of the consciousness of the individual Jewish prayer during this period of the seventh month is it shifts the emphasis of the holiday from the individual, which is what you're concentrating on during Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, to the universal. The rabbi's identification of the 70 animal sacrifices in the Torah to the 70 nations suggest that there's something that is universalistic about this holiday. I have a friend whose parents, both parents, the mother and the father, are Reform rabbis in Los Angeles. And in order to concretize a ritual that demonstrates the universality of Sukkot, each of the 7 days of the holiday, they have dinner with a different ethnic theme. So they might have Italian or Vietnamese in order to get across the idea in a very concrete way about the universalist nature of this holiday. Within the Bible itself, the prophet Zechariah or Zechariah associates the holiday with a universal pilgrimage to Jerusalem and the bestowal of rainfall. Here's Zechariah 14. All who survive of all those nations that came up against Jerusalem shall make a pilgrimage year by year to bow low to the King Lord of hosts and to observe the Feast of Booths. Any of the earth's communities that does not make the pilgrimage to Jerusalem to bow low to the King Lord of hosts shall receive no rain. So this connection between rain and the four species is already a biblical connection. The holiday has in place certain rituals, water libations, in order to promote rainfall. In Babylonia, in the ancient Near East, there was something called sympathetic magic. Sympathetic magic might work like this. We want the earth to be fertile, so we engage in orgiastic sexual activity, which demonstrates our fertility and our pouring out of liquids in order to stimulate the gods pouring out liquids in the form of rain in order to make the world more fertile. So that's probably the anthropological background to some of these holidays and some of these rituals within Sukkot, but the rabbis certainly don't have that understanding of what they're doing. Sukkot in rabbinic literature is called the holiday because it had the flavor of a carnival. Among the spectacles was this ceremony of water libation that was designed to stimulate rainfall. So let me read to you from the Mishnah. They said, anyone who has not seen the joy of Simchat Beit HaShoevah, the joy of the house of drawing water, this water libation festival, anyone who has not seen this has never seen joy. Pious men and men of deeds would dance before them with torches in their hands. I imagine they're juggling with these torches, singing songs and praises. Levites on harps, lyres, cymbals, trumpets, and countless musical instruments were on the 15 steps leading down from the Israelite court to the women's court. So there was music, there was dance, there were these torches, and it was the rabbis, the pious men and the men of deeds, who were shedding all pretense of dignity and engaging in this kind of raucous celebration. Now, I mentioned that Sukkot is a 7-day holiday. This is true. In the Middle Ages, it became a tradition within the mystical stream of Judaism to invite poor guests into your sukkah, because you would eat in the sukkah and you would sleep in the sukkah. In the mystical tradition, these guests were associated with biblical characters. And since there were 7 days of Sukkot, there became a tradition to invite in a different guest every day. And those guests were mapped on to emanations of God in the supernal worlds. We'll spend a whole lecture talking about Jewish mysticism and the Sfirot, but the 7 guests below represent 7 biblical heroes, the patriarchs and Moses and Joshua and King David, and they map onto the supernal flows of energy, and as we invite the guests in, we are stimulating not rain from above, but it's a twist on that idea. We're stimulating divine blessing from above to flow into our world below. So it's no longer just about rain, because after the Jews have left the land of Israel, they're less dependent on rain because they're less dependent on agriculture. They've moved into other areas of the economy, but they're still very dependent on divine blessings. The day after Sukkot ends is not Sukkot. That's why it's the day after Sukkot ends. It's called in the Torah Shmini Atzeret, which literally means ceasing on the eighth, right? Ceasing on the eighth day after Sukkot begins. Now, Sukkot is a seven-day holiday, but the following day, Shmini Atzeret, is another full holiday that's commanded in the Torah. But the Torah leaves the character of that day undefined. It doesn't say that we're supposed to do anything. It doesn't give us any more information about that holiday. The rabbis understand that since Sukkot is a holiday where the Jews engage in ritual to promote rainfall all around the world, that universalist aspect, Shmini Atzeret brings it back to the individual in the Jewish community. Shmini Atzeret is a final day of intimacy just between God and the Jews. We move from the individual to the universal, back to the community with Shmini Atzeret. And what is a text that demonstrates that nicely? Rabbi Alexandrai said, "It is like a king who had a celebration. For 7 days of the feast, the king's son was busy with the guests. After the 7 days of feasting, the king said to his son, 'My son, I know that for 7 days of the feast, you were busy with the guests, being a good host. Now you and I will rejoice together, and I won't trouble you very much. Just one bull and one ram.'" Right? Those were the only animal sacrifices that were required on Shmini Atzeret. In the diaspora, outside of the land of Israel, holidays are kept for 2 days rather than one. This goes back to a problem that the rabbinic community had in alerting communities outside the land of Israel that it was the new moon. There is a requirement that you have testimony from two witnesses that you see a crescent moon in order to determine that the new month has begun. And if you don't know when the new month has begun, you don't know when the 10th of the month is, or the 15th of the month. So within the land of Israel, once they got that testimony, they would go up onto hilltops with torches and signal to the next hilltop with the next torch that that was the new moon. But with far-flung communities in the diaspora, you couldn't rely on that kind of communication. And this was in the days before email and CNN. So they said that if you live in the diaspora, better be safe than sorry. Keep 2 days of the holiday just to be sure you get the right one. So the second day of Sukkot in Israel is only a semi-holiday since it falls between the first day of Sukkot and Shmini Atzeret, that eighth day. These intermediate days are called Chol HaMoed. And if you don't have to work, you don't work. This is usually when school vacations happen in Israel. But outside of Israel, traditional Jews treat the second day of Sukkot as a full holiday. And they treat the day after Shmini Atzeret as another full holiday. Now, in the medieval period, the leaders of the Babylonian Jewish community, who were called Geonim, they decided to give the second day of Shmini Atzeret its own character by having the annual Torah reading conclude and commence on this day. Thus, on Simchat Torah, which is the name they gave, the joy of Torah, on that, in the diaspora, on the day after Shmini Atzeret, during Simchat Torah, you read about Moses' death on Mount Nebo, and then you immediately scroll the entire five books in the form of a scroll back to the beginning, and you return to the creation of the world. That's Simchat Torah. In Israel, Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah are on the same day because they don't have 2 days for the holiday. So the character of that eighth day has really been overwhelmed by Simchat Torah. There really is no Shmini Atzeret, as it were, as a separate holiday in Israel, because you dance around the synagogue with the Torah. Today, it is a fun-filled holiday. Some Reform communities now have started a tradition of unraveling the entire Sefer Torah, of unraveling the entire scroll of the Torah, and having people around the synagogue hold it so that you can see the entire Torah, and then they have the kids go in the middle so that the kids are literally enveloped by Torah, or then you have all of the congregation go in the middle and stand and feel as though you are enveloped in the Torah. And the idea, I think, behind reading about the death of Moses and then the creation of the world is very symbolic in that the Torah never stops. There's always more to the Torah. There's never a point where you say, oh, I've reached the promised land. It's about process. Moses sees the promised land. He glances at the promised land, but he never makes it into it. And so too, we can see the end, but then we go back to the beginning and repeat the journey. repeat the process. And this joyous quality of Simchat Torah that we celebrate today with dancing and with music may very well be reminiscent of the kind of joy that the Israelites experienced in the Second Temple during this pilgrimage festival of Sukkot. Okay, in our next lecture, we will move from the fall holiday cycle to the spring holiday cycle.